session, Climate Change and Cultural Heritage, Gathering Data and Exploring Professional Implications for a Very Different Future. Thank you for coming. We don't have an official financial sponsor, so I want to thank all of us collectively as the sponsors of our time and energy being here, and these four in particular for all of their work and effort. I want to just remind everyone to silence any noise-making devices, except for the baby, who is also potentially a noise-making device, but she can keep talking. So I'm Shannon Supple. I'm from Smith College. I'm really excited to be up here introducing our speakers and giving you a little frame to start. So Ara Tanzi is a digital archivist and records manager at the University of Cincinnati. Her 2015 article, Archival Adaptation to Climate Change, called for a broad response from the American archivist community to consider the impact of climate change on documentary heritage, and she has been working every year since to spread professional awareness on these matters. And this is truth. Like, she's been doing amazing work. Ara previously worked at Tulane University's Louisiana Research Collection and lived in New Orleans for 5 years. She is thrilled to be back in town. Ben, and this is Ara right here, Ben Goldman, right over there, is the Kalin Librarian for Technological Innovations at the Penn State University Special Collections Library, where he works as a digital archivist and oversees the web archiving program. His research interests lie at the intersection of climate change, technology, and archives. Ben has never been to New Orleans before, but this RBMS conference, and generally does not enjoy the heat. Sorry, Ben. Whitney Ray, right over here, is a records management analyst for the state of North Carolina and a former intern at the United States Environmental Protection Agency Library in Research Triangle Park. She is interested in the archival profession, climate change, and social movements, and she enjoys being outside, but we have her inside today. Yeah. Sarah Burke Cahalan, over at the end, is the director of the Marion Library in Dayton, Ohio. She has worked on multiple preservation-related projects, including, most recently, collections move and facilities updates to ensure better conditions for the University of Dayton collections. She has also researched and published on topics around the history of natural history. So these are our speakers. I'm going to go into a general overview, and then I'm going to hand it off to them. So in this seminar, speakers will introduce you to evolving data on the vulnerabilities faced by special collections, libraries, and archives due to climate change. All four presenters will speak, and then we will have about 30 minutes for what we hope is a robust Q&A. So get your minds going and think about what to ask the presenters afterwards. So when we talk about climate change in the context of cultural heritage stewardship and memory work, we tend to think about preservation strategies, disaster preparedness training, and we tend to think in short-term, localized emergencies. But what if everything is shifting around us? We need to think deeper and ecosystemically. Where do we store the evidence of history and culture, and how vulnerable are those spaces? Where should we store that evidence? The where being equally relevant to paper warehouses and server farms. We can't possibly save everything, and that, I think, is the point. What sociopolitical implications are involved? How much of it do we keep, and can we rethink appraisal and stewardship given the cyclonic realities swirling off the port bow? Time is long. What is our responsibility to past and future life? Can we not only reconstruct, but also deconstruct past choices to make space for the future? If we start thinking this big and this deep, it can be overwhelming and terrifying. But we need to start somewhere. We need to focus and be systematic. This, for me, is the fulcrum in the work that Ara, Whitney, and Ben have been and will working on and will be sharing with us today. There are a myriad other factors to consider as we begin to get serious about these conversations. What are we collecting, and what are the implications for collecting institutions given our changing environments? Is what we have in our collections now enough to restart or reconfigure or recreate society? In this thinking, I see indigenous knowledge, how-to manuals, medicinal tracts, and non-human understandings as much more essential. Time stretches beyond any horizon our human minds can comprehend, and we're just here now, along a continuum of organisms, cultures, and biodiverse intelligences. As speculative thinker and writer Octavia Butler wrote, "All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change." So let's grab our go bags and start thinking about how we can meet this undeniable change in the process of preparing for what could be the unpreparable, and do so together.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me? Wonderful. In the first issue of the Rare Books and Manuscripts Librarianship Journal, published in 1986, Columbia University School of Library Service professor Terry Bellinger excerpted several reports that his students wrote about the state of special collections libraries across the country. Bellinger's students completed their reports between 1976 and 85, and they frequently remarked on the poor physical state of many of the collections they visited. They noted visible environmental damage due to bad HVAC systems, fragmented conservation practices, and strained labor conditions for staff. When Bellinger's students started their reports in 1976, scientists were establishing that CFCs, methane, and ozone were major contributors to greenhouse gases, that deforestation had major consequences for future climate scenarios, and many other predictions that are starting to feel all too relevant today. Science Magazine reported that scientists were beginning to express growing concern to each other and to government officials, but that in trying to convey their message to federal policymakers, those concerned with climate have had little apparent success. 1985, the year that Bellinger's students wrote the last reports quoted in his 1986 article, also marked the last time that the global average temperature for the world was cooler than normal. Society has now notched over 400 consecutive months where the average global temperature has been warmer than normal. So while many major research libraries have undoubtedly improved their situations since Bellinger's students wrote their reports, we know that far more special collections libraries continue to struggle with ensuring appropriate staffing and resources for collection preservation. The fact is that while the voices of well-resourced institutions play a major role in our professional discussions, there are many small and community institutions holding a wide array of archives and special collections materials that we rarely hear from, realize exist, or even see on the map. For as long as I have been alive, the average temperature of the planet has moved in one direction, upwards. So if we're headed to a future where the climate outside our building walls will continue challenging the holdings inside our walls, and if many archives and special collections still don't have the level of resourcing or staffing that they need, we need to radically rethink how we deal with concepts of sustainability, stewardship, and preparation within our institutions. The question is not if climate change will affect archives. The question is how and to what extent. And until fairly recently, no one could really answer that question. So tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of NASA scientist James Hansen's testimony to Congress, in which he urged very sharp reductions in fossil fuel use in an environment that feels a little too familiar to the topics of the world today. We know that many of climate change's effects are at this point inevitable, because a certain amount of harm is now inevitable due to atmospheric feedback loops that have resulted from political failure to reduce greenhouse gases over the last three decades. According to the National Climate Assessment, the United States will experience an increasing number of climate change-related trends that will influence residential patterns, agriculture, natural resources, and future investments in infrastructure. Many of these changes will be due to increasingly severe weather and rising sea levels that pose significant danger to most of the population of the country. Climate change is one of the greatest contemporary threats to archival repositories and the records in our custodies. Increasingly severe disasters like hurricanes, floods, and wildfires pose immediate dangers. Archives preserve historical records in multiple formats critical to legal matters, administrative accountability, and and documentary cultural heritage. When these records are lost following extreme weather events, for example, their absence handicaps sociocultural, and economic reconstruction efforts. At best, archives affected by such events might be able to evacuate certain holdings, move their collections to higher grounds, or salvage materials using disaster response teams. But at worst, we know that disasters can result in total loss, with collections of records or even a repository's entire holdings damaged or beyond recovery. Longer-term trends such as human migration and sea level rise may necessitate decisions that concern entire geographic relocation of archival records. So when I began working on the intersection of archives and climate change, one of the major issues I kept running up against was being able to contextualize risk. It's one thing to gesticulate wildly at coastal areas and say, danger, danger. But so is every other place on Miami Beach and other very vulnerable coastal areas. So if entire cities are threatened by rising seas and stormier weather, then what are the appropriate ways to measure risk to archives? And I was very frustrated by our collective professional inability to quantify this in a way to get up and make my colleagues pay attention. So then I discovered another vexing issue, which is that if you ask, where is every archive in the United States, no one can really answer that question. The archives profession doesn't maintain a comprehensive data set of US repositories. And for a profession whose mission is to organize and preserve data and records for all aspects of society, we do a frighteningly terrible job about maintaining data about ourselves and the places in which we work. So we're going to be taking turns throughout this talk, so I'm going to turn it over to Ben now.
Hello. So as you might, as you heard from Shannon, for the past 2 years, Aaron and I have been working to contextualize and quantify climate change risks to archival repositories. And we began with a simple research question that doesn't have a simple answer, which American archival repositories might suffer exposure to the future impacts of climate change. Now, disaster, as we've heard, is often the lens through which our profession views significant weather events. An example of this we kept coming back to in our research was the experience of Jeffrey Williams, Associate Director of the Health Sciences Library at NYU, whose library suffered considerable loss as a result of the 14-foot storm surge caused by Hurricane Sandy in 2012. And he has repeatedly stated publicly that what happened to them was not a failure of planning. They had a disaster plan and even experience with hurricanes before, so much as it was a failure of imagination. So I like to think of our project as an effort to imagine more concretely the types of extreme weather events that could affect specific American archives locations. But it's also important to remember that disaster is not the only threat to libraries and archives as climate changes. It's also a sustainability issue for our operations. And as outside temperatures rise, for example, the cost of maintaining constant temperature and humidity will also increase. And as Sarah has already reminded us, this is especially concerning for repositories with poor environmental controls or limited resources to begin with. There are many other issues and impacts that we could address too, not least of which are the impacts on our users and on ourselves as professionals. So our methods were to map 1,232 archival repositories in the continental United States using locations data helpfully supplied by OCLC. We should note that the mapping we did is in two dimensions only, so we don't know anything about these archives facilities themselves or where within the facilities resources are stored. We have geo-coordinates, basically. We also mapped current and future environmental disturbances using the best available data. For our project, this included disturbances related to catastrophic flooding, like surface runoff, storm surge, and sea level rise, as well as climate disturbances such as temperature and precipitation increase. Then we geographically intersected the two and tried to make sense of the results. So I should say that this project would not have been feasible without the expertise of Nathan Pikelic, who's a geospatial services librarian at Penn State, and Tara Mazurchek, a PhD candidate in the Department of Geography, who performed the actual data analysis. Throughout this process, we learned a lot about the quality and confidence behind climate models and how different models exist to track different future scenarios. I don't want to get into all the details here, but the main thing we want to convey is that no data are perfect. So, you know, everything take, I guess, no data are perfect. I'm going to leave it there. But there's a lot of intentionality and care behind how we've used and interpreted the data that you'll see. Finally, we want to emphasize that this study was only designed to quantify the likelihood of exposure, which here refers to a change in environmental conditions. We cannot, from the available data, adequately assess or quantify an individual repository's ability to absorb or respond to those changes, which here we define as vulnerability. That depends entirely on the unique characteristics of each repository, its personnel, its resources, its facilities, its plans. So now our results. We found 30 locations out of the 1,232 that currently reside within a 500-year floodplain. Houston, you might know, has experienced 3 500-year floods in the past 3 years. We found 18 coastal locations that would likely be inundated by a 1.8 meter or 6 foot sea level rise by 2100. 84 coastal locations that would likely be inundated by a current Category 4 storm surge event if it were a quote-unquote direct hit to the coastline. 219 coastal locations were found to be at some risk of inundation from the combined effects of sea level rise and storm surge. So sea level rise and storm surge intersect in really undesirable ways along our coastlines. We found 92 locations that may experience a 10 degree or greater annual temperature change by 2100, and 93 locations that could receive an additional 10 inches of rain annually over current levels. So in aggregate, we found that nearly every repository mapped is exposed to some amount of climate disturbance, but the combined risks were quite low. We feel this is good news overall, but even one exposure can significantly impact a library or archive. And as we saw with Hurricane Sandy, an institution's exposure cannot always be predicted, especially when past weather is no longer a reliable predictor for future weather. So we have many takeaways from this study, and our article, which is referenced here, offers some specific ideas for future professional efforts, some of which Aaron and I hope to explore further. But the main takeaway we'd want you all to receive from this is that we as a profession and we as professionals working in specific institutional contexts can do more to understand and prepare for the likely risks. As Aaron mentioned in her introduction, an essential first step is simply understanding where our institutions even exist. The 1,232 repositories mapped in our study is a fractional representation of the documentary and print heritage in the US, and we believe it really only represents those institutions with the resources to even participate in an aggregated discovery service like WorldCat, which means we haven't assessed the impacts to local historical societies, community archives, and the many other types of the institutions most likely to be vulnerable to extreme weather. So Aaron and I decided to try and address this gap. And last summer, we received funding from the Society of American Archivists Foundation to find, gather, and standardize archival repository locations data that exists in many pockets throughout our profession. So many pockets. Our research assistant on this project was Whitney Ray, who will now share with you some details on the work she did and what we've accomplished so far.
Thanks, Ben. So I'm going to be talking about the Society of American Archivists Foundation funded grant to find better repository data. Briefly, I'll address the goals, methods, which include data gathering and data processing, and the findings, which also include limitations and the current data set, which we're releasing. So where is the data? Archives don't have anything comparable to IMLS's Museum Universe data file. The archive grid that Era and Ben were originally using contained 1,232 repositories, but they underrepresented small and community archives. Our goals were to identify, gather, and disseminate data on the geographic locations of archival repositories in the United States. We also, to do that, needed to categorize archival repositories by address and type, and then share the data in a reusable and open format. In our methods, we first went down two lists, the Directory of State Archives on the Council of State Archivists website and Regional Archival Organizations on the Society of American Archivists website. Coincidentally, each list had 51 items, so initially there were 102 organizations to contact. However, often a contact at an organization would provide information about other groups in the area who they thought may maintain a directory. Using this snowball discovery technique, we reached out to many more organizations. We also, in turn, had several individuals hear about our work and reach out to provide us with data or suggest other groups. So in total, we contacted 151 archival organizations, the majority of which were state historical records advisory boards, state archives, and regional groups. I'd like to acknowledge the tremendous work of archivists, volunteers, students, librarians, and memory workers to make archives visible and to protect cultural heritage. This project would not have been possible if not for that work that preceded us. Members of archives organizations were incredibly generous with their time and data. In this process, we also learned much about the landscape of archival organizations. Some, such as the Charleston Archives, Libraries, and Museums Council, were formed in the wake of natural disasters. The bulk of this data was collected between August and December of 2017. And we also experimented with a couple other methods, including a Google survey. And finally, the eventual non-response, we had out of these 151 organizations contacted, 10 did not provide any data. But we tried to be as consistent as possible in contacting organizations at least three times. A rough estimate were 34,533 data points. This included data from all 50 states as well as Washington, D.C. So this data was wildly variant in content, format, currency, and even whether the buildings identified were archives. We were reluctant to eliminate any data which might point to the existence of an archives. So here are some examples. This is an archived website from the Arizona Cultural Inventory Project. We also had some issues about how we defined an archive. The Society of American Archivists defines it as any type of organization that holds documents, including business, institutional, and government archives, manuscript collections, and government libraries, museums, and historical societies, and in any form, including manuscripts, photographs, moving image, and sound materials, and their electronic equivalents. In practice, we found that many organizations included this information on cultural heritage institutions, not strictly archives. So here's an example of a directory provided by the Delaware Valley Archivist Group. It's often came in as PDFs or in different formats, and this contained repositories from multiple states. So we have a PO box. Initially, I made my best effort to track down the physical location of archives. But after digging through website after website, which sometimes didn't disclose the location or had multiple locations, including several different museums and historical houses, it quickly became not very feasible to do so. So for data processing, we had some best practices developed, and we coded data by repository type and location data and location type. So in sum, we contacted 151 groups. There were 30,000 preliminary archival repository locations, and so far we have 15,758 clean entries in 30 states and Washington, D.C. So really, after 9 months, we're close, but we have some ways to go. So findings, the limitations of this data set, we were using extant data sources. This included personal addresses from individual archivists, a part of professional groups, and exact addresses, And we know that there are some things or some repositories that are definitely not identified, but since we were focusing on extent data and didn't want to impose on the sources, we tried to keep our editing minimal, our modification of the sources minimal. There's also a range of specificity, and some addresses included information about the location of archives within a building, and such as the third floor of the county courthouse. Finally, we encountered this, we also encountered categorization issues. So, is it an archive, or is it strictly a cultural heritage group organization? And is it the subject, or how do we classify either by subject of material or the institutional control of the archive? So, I also want to recognize that there are some reasons why organizations don't want to be included in this project. Small community archives, particularly without the resources for staffing hours, as well as corporate archives that are only for internal company use. And there are other reasons as well. So this is an iterative approach. We haven't gotten to all of the data, and we haven't processed multi-state groups. So lots of caveats, but getting to just an example of the numbers. So original set in the Gulf Coast states, we started out with 104 in the OCLC archive grid set, and we're now at 2,608. So this is an example of, ARTNZ made this map here, and it's, if we wanna click, you can go to it. It's a shortened UR. And it's loading. And so currently we have New Orleans, Houston, and Miami pinpoint up here. And you can drag it back and forth to show how. I know. You came for the map. We can also zoom out. Air's going to be talking about more about why this matters, but this is just a sample of what's to come, really. Thank you.
Okay, so why does the work of gathering 30,000 data points for U.S. Archives matter? Well, not to martyr ourselves too much, but about 2 hours into this project, the three of us suddenly realize why no one's ever done this before. So you know, we're doing some important work here. But you know, my background is my undergraduate background is as a geographer. And it is very hard to say anything about the geography of archives without the data on where archives are and where archivists perform their work. So, while the methodology that we use to gather this data on where archives are and where archivists work, originally this data gathering effort was inspired by our previous work on climate change, but just the data gathering, we weren't trying to assess, well, you know, is this on the beach, whatever. But once we started getting enough data, I, as someone who knows a little enough about GIS to be dangerous with it, wanted to start looking at, well, like, I'm very interested in these ideas of vulnerability and exposure, so what are we working with here? So we know that climate change has enormously disruptive potential in threatening the vital records that ensure citizens' rights, as well as the documentary memory of local cultures and communities. By springtime, we had enough data from our efforts for each coastal state, and I began creating prototype maps to see how many geographically vulnerable frontline archives are out there. I am by nature exceptionally skilled at catastrophizing, and I wanted to see what available worst-case scenario data could show me about sea level rise in archives. So for any of you who are interested in learning about this, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which has the lovely acronym NOAA. I actually never made that connection between like the biblical Noah and the fact that they study flooding until about a year ago, and that light bulb went off in my head. I was like, whoa, it's really deep. But what you can do is you can take NOAA sea level rise data and put it over the top of locational data points. So that's what I'm going to show you over the next few slides. This is what southern Louisiana is going to look like with 6 feet of sea level rise. And again, let me just go back to something on the last slide. The party line from NOAA from 2012 is that there will be between 8 inches and 6.6 feet of sea level rise by 2100. A lot of scientists say that that is a conservative estimate, that it either could be more by then or some of these effects could be happening sooner than 2100. So the dark blue, that big cluster of repositories, that's New Orleans. The dark blue above it is Lake Pontchartrain, so that's current Lake Pontchartrain. But everything that is light blue, that is inundation over current visible landmass. This is what the Texas coast will look like. This is what South Florida looks like. So I have made a number of these prototype maps. These are available online, so anyone can put in these addresses and take a look at things. And if anyone is interested in learning how to do that, let me know. I would be glad to show you. But I should say, a lot of, and this is the disclaimer that NOAA will always give, is that this is very high-level data. And just to echo what Ben and Whitney have already said, we don't know anything about, like, is this archive, you know, are the archives in the basement? Are they on the top floor? You know, what is the slope of the area you're on? So this should all be taken as very, like, high-level advice or thinking, and not necessarily about what is going to happen at your particular archive. If you really want to get that, you actually have to hire someone who is a specialist and probably gets paid a lot more than archivists do to tell you these kinds of things. So when we started doing this work, we knew that we were working with something big. We obviously wanted this data for climate change stuff, but we knew that lots of people could use this for other things. We've been contacted by researchers who say, I'm just trying to find out, you know, where are all the archives in the state, because I keep feeling like maybe I'm missing something. We know that our colleagues in other archival organizations could use this. So from the start, we knew that we wanted to make this data publicly available. And what we have processed so far is available in a GitHub repository. There are 30 states available today in spreadsheet format, plus Washington, D.C. We are working through the rest of the data, so as that comes online, it will be available here. I want to briefly note that we are working very hard on trying to establish a long-term home for this data. We know and we are prepared that lots of people will probably tell us as soon as they look for this, like, oh, I see something wrong. Oh, this needs to be changed. And we are very cognizant that this is imperfect. But one of the things that this needs is a long-term institutional home for the stewardship of this. So we are having conversations with Society of American Archivists, since they were the funders of this project, about the feasibility of establishing that kind of maintenance relationship of the data in the future. So this is really sobering stuff. I realize this, but one of the things that we should recognize is that we are all in this together. And one of the things that I've found really profound in Bellinger's students, to go back to the beginning of this talk, they were so astute. And I want to close with one of the observations that one of them wrote about a collection that they were reporting on. A collection such as this one cannot be judged safe simply because it is in relatively good shape today. It is meant to last as long as the university lasts, as a resource for posterity, which may well find new ways to extract knowledge from it we cannot now even begin to envisage. Its condition must, consequently, be judged from the perspective of a very long span of time indeed. And in this world, time passes faster than we realize. Threats of physical decay, of theft, of ignorant mutilation, these are unlikely to be visible at any one given moment, but they persist for the long haul. Given the basic condition, a decision to do nothing becomes a decision to leave the collection vulnerable to such threats.
You didn't name the students. Thanks.
Sarah Cahalan, University of Dayton. Clifton Gorge was carved out by a stretch of the Little Miami River that funnels through a narrow path in the bedrock. The gorge itself is about 40 feet deep, and the stretch of river is notable for rapids and small waterfalls. The white settlers of Ohio noted the power of the swiftly moving water and built a grist mill there by around 1803. By 1812, a cotton and wool mill was providing cloth for American soldiers stationed in Ohio. At its largest, the mill spanned the gorge 4 stories tall with an enormous wheel to take full advantage of the river's water power. Then a series of floods destroyed the mill. All that's visible of it today are the square holes in the rock where the mill was anchored to the gorge, which you can see in the bottom right. I'm starting with this as an example of my adopted landscape in western Ohio. Despite the fact that our profession pulls us to be somewhat itinerant, even the most subject-specific or internationally recognized special collection is a part of its community. We as individuals are not just interchangeable cogs, we are parts of our places too. This is also an example of places as palimpsests. There was a mill here, but now it's gone. Many of the changes we impose on the world are more permanent and irreversible than a mill made of wood and metal. The fossil fuels we use to come to this conference are more impactful on the climate than a cotton mill. What I'm suggesting is that when we think about long time, many of the things we consider permanent, whether it's our structures or the items in our collections, are, after all, just temporary. It's too late now to reverse climate change, though it's not too late to make some changes that diminish its impact. On the other hand, climate might just intervene and render most of us and our institutions irrelevant, just traces on the landscape like the remains of this cotton mill. Good morning. Sorry. it gets worse. climate change inevitably now means climate refugees, damaged economies, disastrous impact on ecosystems, floods, and fires. We can plan for it with some of the tool set we have become accustomed to using for emergency preparedness and preservation, but a certain amount of hysteria and existential dread might not be a bad idea. I just want to point out, I am not an expert. I am lucky to be up here on a panel with people who have developed some really solid data that the rest of us non-experts now need to digest and incorporate into our profession. On day one of this conference, we talked about paradigm shifts, and this is one of them. So some of my suggestions may be a bit provocative, and probably some of them are wrong, but honestly, given the scope of the situation, we just have to start talking about it more. More of us have to start talking about it. All right. We need to think both about professional best practices over the next decades, as well as about possible long-term futures for our vocation, not just our profession, our vocation, keeping in mind that many decisions may end up being made for us by circumstances. So I've agreed to present on some of the implications for our professional best practices. Some of these are suggestions that have already been posited in the literature by my co-panelists here, among others, and they include considering the dangers of fire, storm surge, changing floodplains, and rising sea levels in our emergency plans, strengthening our relationships with emergency response professionals, such as firefighters and other first responders, considering local shifting of collections within buildings or between buildings, depending on the implications of climate change on our regions, strengthening regional partnerships and commitments for possible cooperation in response to crises, considering environmental risks when addressing landscape and building decisions, and especially when designing new buildings, if we're designing new buildings, considering relocating some collections altogether, making decisions about collection development on what, based on what we can responsibly agree to preserve. And most of this, some of this, is already part of preservation best practice, but some of it can be reframed in the context of emerging data. I think we also need to interrogate what best means when we talk about best practice. Best for who, best for what. I think we can acknowledge that our profession itself is tied up in institutions and practices that are degrading to the environment. Increasingly, we see sustainability initiatives on campuses and other institutions, and these are to be commended, but they are often rolled out in the context of institutions that are funded, say, by business or military contracts that may not contribute to a culture of sustainability writ large. Our own best practices and what is best for our collections, both physical and digital, can be a major eater of fossil fuels and other resources. Just as we have in recent years been interrogating the elitism and exclusivity built into quote-unquote special collections, it is important to consider that what we preserve may be preserved at the expense of something else. It's not a zero-sum game. We don't have to choose between the stuff and the world, right? But we do have to acknowledge that our profession itself has a carbon footprint, and that best practices within a professional context may have non-optimal implications beyond that context. And then the final items on the list are relationships, right? As in many situations, relationships are the most important thing. I think we need more relationships with our neighbors, formal or informal consortial agreements, and we need to work on the relationships that we already have in place. So just a quick word about collection development. Do we have a responsibility to pass on materials that we can't adequately steward? We already do turn collections and items away for reasons of money and space. What about items that would be perfect for our collection but cannot appropriately be preserved in our region? I'm showing an example of museums having these conversations in coastal Florida. We can talk about this hypothetically, but we can also incorporate specific text into our collection development policies. Are any of us prepared to do that? Here's just an initial shot across the bow of some model text that could be adapted for local use and collection development policies, given the real danger of climate catastrophe in our region, known implications of which include X, Y, and Z. The library may need to decline items that would otherwise fit the specifications of this policy, et cetera. Language like this might send donors in the other direction, right? But maybe it's the responsible thing to do. We can also think about how items in our collections could be prioritized for preservation, digitization, display, and publication based on the stories they can tell about the changing air, land, and sea. This is an example of a map by an illustrator who primarily worked on plants and insects of the Ozarks, who I've been studying in collaboration with our colleague Jason Dean. Dumbarton Oaks, as a result of our research project, prioritized his works for digitization. The availability of the digital images, along with our initial publication, has led to increased interest in the artist, in particular from people in the region of the country where he worked. We've received multiple emails, not from scholars so much as from nature lovers who are fascinated by the history of their place once we started writing about him. And so the map from one of his manuscripts shows an area of the Missouri Ozarks that has changed dramatically in the past century as dams were created and rivers. And the area surrounding his homestead was transformed into a theme park, multiple theme parks actually, and motels and parking lots. So images such as these can tell the stories of places as palimpsests, and they can allow people who loved those places even a century ago or centuries ago to speak alongside us for the preservation of specific landscapes and ecosystems. More immediately, but related to digitization and publication, we can look to our colleagues at Data Refuge, who've been saving and using governmental scientific data from before November 2016. As we all know from answering that perennial question from visitors, what makes a book rare, the answer is a complicated algorithm that takes into account age, scarcity, replaceability, and best practice. And as soon as this governmental data became vulnerable, it became a special collection too. So I want to pivot from building and promoting collections to storage conditions for our collections and ask, do we need to interrogate and challenge what we have learned about temperature and humidity for special collection storage? This one rings really close to home for me because I work with a collection that's situated in an ill-equipped 1970s building in a part of the country with great variation between winter and summer temperatures. Just last week, we had water coming through the ceiling. I consider it a part of my job to repeatedly and consistently advocate for improved environmental conditions for collections that are vulnerable to our buildings' fluctuations in temperature and humidity. And I've had some success in getting improved spaces and equipment for portions of the collection, and it is so useful to be able to name specific numbers and ranges in our communications with facilities and other stakeholders. So I don't necessarily want to walk into the room and say, well, it's kind of fuzzy. Like, you know, we can, but many of us were fascinated to learn from an RBMS keynote several years back about new work being done by the Image Permanence Institute about best practices with regards to environmental settings. So I'm sorry, this slide is full of text, but the top two sources are the ones that we, or at least I, learned in preservation programs in my library program, and the National Park Service recommends temperatures between 65 and 70 degrees and a relative humidity between 40 and 55%. NEDCC suggests aiming for stable temperature no higher than 70 and a stable relative humidity between a minimum of 30 and a maximum of 50, but acknowledges disagreement and emphasizes the importance of stability. But the overall gist in both documents is that the lower end of these ranges would be better. NEDCC continues to say the climate-controlled system should never be turned off and settings should not be lowered at night, on weekends, or at other times when the library or archives are closed. Additional costs incurred by keeping the system in constant operation will be far less than the cost of future conservation treatment to repair damage caused by poor climate. But then the third text on the screen is from one of the publications coming out of this IPI, IMLS, NEH work on sustainable preservation practices, such as shutting off HVAC for specific periods and building with insulation and window types that might mitigate fluctuation of temperature and humidity. And they suggest that RH can actually safely fluctuate up to 60%, and that the standard of 70 degrees Fahrenheit might not actually be ideal for some collections. It says that these old standards with minimal fluctuation is expensive to maintain and usually not ideal. So that's good to know, although I am, as I mentioned, genuinely hesitant to bring this to our conversations with people on campus, because I don't want to be, you know, the victim of, like, greenwashed cost-saving masquerading as sustainability until we're 100% sure that this is actually best for our collections. Anyway, I am a well-behaved adherent to best practices myself, so I think it's challenging our accepted best practices can liberate us to focus on what's possible with regards to stability in our collections. And then just spinning off of that for a moment, for the sake of this morning's argument, since we are talking about really long time, what if we assume that it's too late for sustainability anyway? What can we do when, not if, these environmental control systems break down altogether? What does stability look like in that scenario? How do we mitigate mold in the absence of HVAC? Maybe we prioritize getting materials into locations that are naturally as close to ideal conditions as possible. Maybe we identify regional or national locations that would be environmentally stable without significant expenditures of resources that may no longer be readily available. Maybe we prefer a distributed model and accept some long-term loss. Suffice it to say that climate change will have profound implications for our conversations about security and access. So as Shannon indicated in her introduction, most of our current emergency plans are focused on a single event, such as a fire or a flood. They assume a return to normal at some point following the event. In some cases, they include strategies for maintaining service while we recover from the emergency, but what if recovery is not guaranteed? Should our plans include the possibility of long-term relocation? Maybe, depends probably on the institution. Again, I mean, that really comes back to those conversations about communities of patrons, and I mean, there are archives that really need to be where the people are who use those archives, right? At the very least, I think we have to integrate text about regional disasters into our emergency plans, text to the effect of good faith commitment to assist with disasters in other regional collections. And then again, spinning off of that, should our plans also include serious consideration of speculative, paranoid, borderline hysterical strategies? thanks. I'm in the right room. many plans already do include lists of priority items to save. Should they also include strategies, perhaps anathema to our minimalist and streamlined sensibilities, such as stockpiling supplies for a time when production and distribution systems break down, or keeping technology on hand, such as card catalogs, typewriters, printing presses, mimeograph machines, other reproductive technologies, for a time when the systems don't come back up after an emergency. You know, I don't think it's a bad idea to imagine possible options for a very different future. We can't prepare for everything, but if we don't plan ahead, the plans may be made for us by people with other agendas and not on our terms. So having things documented ahead of time does have a certain power. Documents have power. And here's some more document power. You know, let's talk about how we can build sustainability work and disaster recovery work into our job descriptions and into our library's mission statements. When we acknowledge the importance of this work in our mission, we endorse the work from an institutional perspective. We are all familiar with the grinding need to do more with less. Sometimes the pressure comes from outside, sometimes we place the pressure on ourselves. Too seldom do we talk about what we can stop doing in order to start doing something new. Discussion of sustainability work and disaster recovery work can be an eye-roll-inducing stressor in an already overwhelmed workplace. So the first thing we can do is to acknowledge that it is real work, it's not an extracurricular hobby, and then we can make it part of our institutional workflows. Including this work in our documents, whether it's our emergency plans, our collection development policies, our job descriptions, or our strategic plans, legitimizes the work and gives institutional imprimatur to the reality of the data. Professional networks. most people on Earth never fly on an airplane, right? So almost everyone at this conference is an outlier in that regard already. We all know that there is an environmental impact associated with our professional activities. Some of that is acceptable, right? Living creatures have impact on their environment, but some of it may be excessive. I love RBMS and completely recognize the value of in-person networking and community building, but what if we considered an in-person conference every other year and a virtual conference in those alternate years? What if, and this is something to bring back to institutions, what if, where relevant, annual review and promotion or tenure documents actually valued regional presentations over national presentations? I don't want our institutions to use sustainability as an excuse to cut professional development funding, but we do need to admit that many best practices are informed by perceptions of status. The perception that I must be an important person because I get to fly all over the country, or my library is an important collection because it can afford a state-of-the-art special collections facility. Those are some short-term considerations. Moving beyond that and recognizing that I'm probably going to go a little over time, I will cut a bit here. But let's assume that it's too late for sustainability. What can we do if our professional networks break down? Fortunately, many of us are familiar with historical methods of scholarly communication. There are lots of ways to convey information, and I don't want to go too into it. I do have an interesting example about a missionary communicating across boundaries and so on in the 18th century, and then realizing that the Iroquois among whom he was proselytizing actually already knew this information already. and we don't need to look to the reports of missionaries and scientific societies. We could just as easily look at zines, traded hand-to-hand, self-published works on women's health that created spaces and communities across space and time. This is what happened to a lot of the stuff in my tote bag. and we are actually having a subcommittee on sustainability for the planning committee for next year's conference. I welcome your thoughts on other things, too, but, we're going to do our best, and obviously recognizing that conferences are inherently not a sustainable practice, but what can we do, and what can we do for next year, and what should we do long-term? Send them at me. So at my library, we've recently been working with a community in Kibeho, Rwanda, on the preservation of a collection there that dates back to the 1980s. In the Rwandan genocide of the 1990s, several of the creators of the archive were killed and others were forced into hiding or left the country for safety. The materials of the collection that have survived did so because they were distributed and hidden. Now some of the materials are back where they originated. Some are in Europe and North America. Not everything did survive, but enough made it through the bottleneck that the community can still tell a story about the original incidents, but almost as importantly, a story about their survival as a community and the survival of the materials. So as cultural heritage professionals, we're familiar with similar stories around the rise of ISIS. Similar strategies were used in Bosnia and Kosovo. The library created by Abi Warburg is only in London today because Fritz Soxel oversaw its covert transfer from Germany in 1933. Is there a model here for plans we make either as a profession or perhaps more quietly internal to our institutions about how to respond to a catastrophic break from the normal? When do we know if a catastrophe is catastrophic enough to suspend everyday rules? I don't know. In conclusion, I did want to talk briefly about some of the ways that information survives. I'll give one example from fantasy and one example from reality. In N.K. Jameson's Broken Earth series, there's an ancient wisdom known as stone lore, which is presented at first as an infallible set of survival techniques. It's ancient, it's learned by children in school. But as the trilogy unfolds, we realize that even this ancient knowledge has been edited and overwritten and censored for political gain over millennia. There's a reason Tablet 2 is so damaged. Someone somewhere back in time decided it wasn't important or it was wrong and didn't bother to take care of it. Or maybe they even deliberately tried to obliterate it, which is why so many of the early copies are damaged in exactly the same way. So that's the fantasy example. The second example from reality is the Wiradjuri manuscript. It's based on stories related by the native Indians of the mountains of Peru, people who were aware of the Incan Empire but not entirely part of it. Written in Quechua and then transliterated in Roman script in the late 16th century under the supervision of the Catholic Church, it's one of multiple examples of pre-Columbian cultures being documented at the very time they were being forcibly oppressed, ushered into being by the very people who were oppressing them. So the text is a complicated mix of ancient myth, recent history of the previous century of colonial presence, and overlaid Christian interpretation. But as you can see from the slide on the screen, there's a certain reticence even in the European explanation of the ancient mythology. Like, the story is told, and then a Christian interpretation is substituted, and then maybe that's what it was. The story sort of tells itself and untells itself simultaneously, but it's still told. So the text that was meant to undermine the so-called idolatry of the region, but the product is in fact a storehouse of lore that otherwise would have been lost. So the first example I gave from fantasy shows the ephemerality of things we perceive as permanent in the context of geological time. Very few of our holdings will last in that context anyway. Things we accept as certain may not be certain. My baby is crying out in the hall. But the second example from reality attests to the insistent power of information. Information sneaks its way into new contexts in ways we might not expect. But it's not a passive process, it's a people process. We build mills, we build libraries, we fly in airplanes, we buy products, we work too much, we know our spaces aren't neutral, and we know everything's political, but we also have 100 deadlines and our obligations to people inside and outside of the institutions. We write documents and design workflows that reflect our priorities as individuals and as a profession. And every day we make decisions about exactly what's urgent and what we ignore. Thanks.
Damn, that was good. I hope you all liked that as much as I did. So now we have some time for questions, comments, conversation. So please come up to the mic. I'm asking everyone to use the mic. Not everyone can hear if you don't. Thank you so much, and take it away, Kate.
What are you primarily envisioning as the first reuse of your data. I'm thinking about I'm thinking about lots of things, and I'm thinking about also translating this. You know, yesterday we had this session about shared print repositories, and so also some documents about your hows are going to be really useful, I think, as somebody might embark on that similar project. So I'm wondering what you've already thought about in terms of the reuse of this data.
So I think we're going to do the mapping project again, maybe, with the larger data set. I don't personally want to say any ideas beyond that. Part of the reason why we put it in GitHub is we want people to find it and creatively think of things to do with it. And we just had one of our good colleagues and friends from the profession contact us this week at the conference saying, oh, it's in GitHub. Can I write some scripts and tools and do something with it? And yeah. Erin might have more ideas she wants to do.
Thank you very much for that. I'm Elizabeth Odd from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I particularly want to thank you guys for frankly discussing this issue of best practices and that professional best practices may not be environmental best practices. And I wanted to sort of bring that around to talking a little bit about mass digitization and its environmental impact. And Sarah, thank you for talking about collection development. And I guess I want to hear thoughts on, sometimes I think we look to digitization as a way of, as a kind of preservation, right? Do we need to have multiple digital copies of something on servers, in air-conditioned buildings, running 24 hours a day, at inhumanly cold temperatures, as well as a building where we're preserving a physical document, which also has its environmental impact. So I guess this is just my sort of call for appraisal that more than ever, our professional expertise is called to make real decisions about what we preserve for the future and why we're preserving it and what the impact of that is.
I definitely don't want to dominate up here, but I just want to say, digital preservation is fundamentally non-sustainable, if you ask me. And I think that's baked into our professional theories and practices. I read the OAIS model as the language of sprawl, to be honest. We had a conversation in our Slack channel recently at Penn State about how our storage and our repository is being used. And someone made the comment that 75% of the storage is being used by copies and derivatives.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, and I think it does go back to what I was saying about a certain sense of if we need to have it because we know our collection is important. I mean, believe me, I want to provide the very best conditions possible for my collections. We wouldn't be here as professionals if we didn't care about this stuff. But I do think there's a certain amount of almost like elitist striving and trying to get the most systems instead of maybe just recognizing that there are some systems that we, you know, if we can't afford it, maybe we shouldn't have it, and we do our best with what we have. We don't always need more. We don't always need the next thing. That goes for our personal lives as well as our professional lives.
Hi, I'm Amy Chin. I'm from the University of Iowa. You guys blew my mind. I love the data work you did. But I'll move on to what was actually a really small point in your presentation, Sarah, which was about swag and the amount of trash generated by the conference. And that's something I thought about a lot. So I would just kind of like to open up the conversation in terms of like having you guys reflect more, or even maybe after this talk with the panelists about like what is reasonable, considering that we want to be respectful to the people who support our conference, but also what's realistic in terms of maybe thinking more strategically about our environmental impacts. And that also extends to our libraries. I know that we give out a lot of swag. and that's a great outreach tool, but I always just think about the closet of plastic that we have at Iowa, and I know that we're not alone. So anyway, I'm interested in thoughts and other people, like what we can do to combat that culture, because that's something that seems so endemic to our profession.
I agree. I think if we can't eliminate it altogether, I think at the very least we could be thoughtful about swag that will actually be used. Something like a pencil as opposed to a pen or whatever. I mean, these are little things, and it's like kind of whistling into the hurricane or whatever. It's worth at least thinking about. I know, my own personal thoughts on some of the swag that we get at RBMS is that I find it so unnecessary. And I use the electronic catalogs anyway, which I know there are also carbon issues tied up with those files. But I don't see the need to get quite such a big pile. I'm just as likely to buy something from you if it's not in a printed catalog.
I'm really glad this swag conversation is happening, but I would also caution that, to me, this is almost like the obsession about plastic straws I see in social media at the moment. So the major source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States is from road-based transportation. So if you give up straws, great, but if you're still commuting every day to work in a single occupancy vehicle, if you have access to a bus, you're going to make a lot more of an impact if you take a bus to work every day. And so one of the things that I would love to see in our profession is, I work for an employer that subsidizes my bus transit pass, so I can take the bus to work. And so that's sort of the thing that, it's great to, reduce the tote bag industrial complex, but also, I think we need to think holistically and actually look at, what are the sources of emissions. And so I would love to see an institution that would actually subsidize more travel funding for lower carbon ways of getting to conferences. So if you take the megabus, you get more funding for your travel than if you take a plane. That would be amazing. Please, someone do that.
Hi, Carrie Hinks from Emory University. I want to take a minute to go back to digital preservation and our strategies around that. It's something I was thinking a lot about during the first part of the presentation, and thinking that at this point, not only the environmental impact of the current way we do but thinking about the fact that more and more institutions are going to using things like Amazon Web Services, and as a steward of my collection data, I don't actually physically know where that lives and how vulnerable it is.
Virginia.
But with any number of services that we use, so can we talk a little, I just want to hear your thoughts about how this distributed stewardship model that we have both has an impact on the environment, but also the way that it takes away some of our control potentially over our own institutional data.
I have a big problem with this too. HathiTrust, the digital preservation network, I think maybe even HathiTrust all use Amazon Web Services now. I shouldn't look at any names, but I think there's a real question of possibly divestment. I say Virginia because that's, I think, where the concentration of Amazon's the biggest cluster is, and Virginia gets all of its power from Duke Energy, which is coal. So.
And they're doing eminent domain on African American householders.
Yeah, so there's so many issues with this,
Hi, I'm Regina Brand from Stanford Libraries. I'm the head of preservation. So partner with your preservation departments if you have them. Not everybody does, because we're thinking about this stuff all the time. And thank you for bringing up the 2014 thing. That was a thing. Let's talk about storage and cluttering. one of the things that we are discussing in the preservation and conservation world, we just had the AIC conference in Houston a couple weeks ago, and a lot of these issues of how we're still giving out this environmental data when we're seeing all these examples of not needing to be so stringent with them, why? And there's actually a really interesting thread coming up through the conservation literature about the psychology of uncertainty and how conservators, and I bring it out to librarians because I am a librarian, are really uncomfortable saying, we just don't know. Yeah. It's like we have some of this data, we're making these decisions, we just don't know. And I think we can get better about admitting that.
Yeah.
Admitting that.
Yeah, no, thank you for saying that. That's helpful actually for me. I thought of this in my talk. I think a lot of us, maybe I'm over revealing things about myself right now, but there's like that real imposter syndrome, especially when you're fairly new to an institution, and maybe you're meeting a group of people who have decision-making power for the first time. And so there's something really effective about saying, well, this is best practice. Like, I know it. And so to go into that room, for me, especially with a bunch of like older men who know the buildings way better than I do, it's like helpful to be able to say, like, I know it. And so but I hear what you're saying. I mean, sometimes maybe you can say best practice is evolving. Maybe there are ways to articulate it where you still sound really smart, but like you're part of the conversation and engage other stakeholders on campus who are thinking about these things, because we're not the only ones. I mean, we have a sustainability institute on my campus in a brand new building.
Just on that best practices part before I get to the question for you guys. In the Invisible Labor panel, someone was talking about a report of what they called it better practices.
Yeah.
I really liked that.
That is good.
It's like, how can you say these are better practices than best practices? Because best practices change.
Right.
All the time. We know they evolve.
Right.
As part of the IU Plus group, we're talking about shared print a lot between the 13 libraries. And I always bring up the geographic concerns because Stanford is the furthest west. And I'm always like, but what about if there's an earthquake out here and we only hold it? Or there's another superstorm Sandy and everything is in the Cambridge area. So what kind of suggestions do you guys have, or have you thought about the way that we can keep bringing up this geographic issue for those kind of consortial things? So,
go ahead.
So what I would say is, certainly as someone who's from Ohio but also lived here for several years, I mean, the reality is that nowhere, I mean, we know that certain areas will hit more vulnerabilities than others just by virtue of where they are along the coastlines or other areas. But no place is really truly safe. I mean, in August of 2016, there was a thunderstorm. You know, Cincinnati is some of the fewest natural disasters in any major city in the country. But there was a thunderstorm that parked over an area of the city that was nowhere close to the Ohio River. And 2 years later, people are still fighting with the city about the sewage overflows that happened in their basement. So I think one of the things that I think is really incumbent upon us to always sort of maintain a sense of reality and perspective and humbleness is that there really is no safe harbor. Like that is, and this is why like climate change is like the universal problem of our time and of our world, is that there are places that are quote safer than others, but bad things can still go down. So it's I think it goes back to what you were saying before about you weigh the uncertainty as best you can. This is why I think it's come up briefly. This is why I think the idea of acceptable loss is one of the most important paradigm shifts that we need to embrace in our profession, because the idea that we can like be the vanguard against loss is just not realistic. So.
Just to build on that too, I think to me the idea of acceptable loss really fits into our notions of growth. And I mean, I don't know any repository that actually shrinks its collections every year, but like that might be what makes us sustainable.
Hi, Derek Webb. I'm at Mississippi University for Women. First, I want to say this is an amazing presentation. I'm going to take a lot of this home. And I'm glad that you talked about potential solutions of all kinds, including long-term relocation of materials. But I'm from one of those small regional Gulf Coast universities who collect mainly within my small community. And that particular way, admittedly from a very selfish standpoint on my part, intersects in a not great way when I think about documenting my underdocumented communities in my locale, and I tell them, well, maybe my small college archives isn't the best one to handle your records in case of climate change, but we can just displace your cultural patrimony over to Denver and... Wondering if y'all had any thoughts about that.
concern, and that's why it's been really inspiring to see how many efforts have been undertaken in the past, particularly around issues that have already happened. So I brought up the Charleston Area Libraries and Museum Council on that. That, I think, is a really great model to develop, collective development policies as well as strategies for dealing in a specific region and among a specific community. So,
yeah, Derek, that's a great point that I'm glad you brought up. My personal philosophy tends to be that collections are best served where they have geographic and community locations. So I definitely share your concern. So one person that you may actually want to look at his work is Matthew Gordon Clark. He's an Australian archivist that has studied sort of the National Archives of Pacific Island Nations, which, those are, they involve the questions that you are bringing up, but on a national scale. And so it's like, okay, if the people of a nation have to be relocated because their island nation is going to be underwater, where do their archives go? If their archives go to like state archives in New Zealand, how should those be administered? And so these are like real questions. And they also get back to sort of larger questions that are outside of some of the control of archivists, which is like community relocation. What does that look like? And that's already happening in the United States. It's certainly happening among tribal communities here in Louisiana and here in Alaska. So it's something that everyone is figuring out as we go along.
Hi, my name is Tara Emerson, and I live in Sonoma County, California. And just last October, we had devastating wildfires that tore through the city of Santa Rosa and other areas. 42 people were killed, 4,600 homes were destroyed, pretty much overnight. I work at a public library there. And luckily, all of our branches survived, but the one that was most threatened was actually where we housed the county archives. And our director was in conversation with the fire department about trying to prioritize protecting that building, but at the same time, and our branches were all closed for a week and a half, none of us could work. But for the first couple of days of the disaster, the firefighters weren't even trying to put out the fire. They weren't trying to save buildings, they were trying to save lives, they were trying to get people out. So I guess my question is kind of, how do we balance prioritizing preserving our collections versus preserving human life? And also, how do we write into our collection development plans and policies staff safety and just really thinking about the human aspect of disaster as well.
I think you're starting to answer your own question, which is that don't wait until the disaster happens, right? Because then it is much more urgent concerns than our boxes, which is why we're doing this work honestly, is to try to just say, hey, like, start your planning now before it actually becomes dire.
Yeah, and I think the one thing, I apologize if people have heard me say this before, but one of the things that I keep harping on every time this topic comes up is that archives are only part of memory work, right? And there's a lot of things that we can learn from traditional forms of knowledge. The way that we share stories with one another, that is a form of preserving memory. And so, ultimately, and those forms of memory transmission are actually a lot more stable than archives are. And so, it goes without a doubt that human life is always going to take precedence over a bunch of hollander boxes, and that's partly because humans have far more creativity as well in transferring memory to one another than a box can.
I think what I was getting at with some of those examples about war and other catastrophic situations is just being mindful, even if it's not something that we want to document in a public way for our collections, but maybe having some conversations about when it gets really bad, can we suspend the rules? I mean, a lot of the ways that things have survived in some of these really awful situations is because people took things home with them. And, when they got some
burner phones, and fortunately they had a network and they were able to communicate with each other and tell each other where they were. And it doesn't go along with our sensibilities, and normally we'd be fired for that, right? But maybe having some conversations about, well, when it reaches this level of bad, then we can suspend some of those rules.
Hi, I am the library director for a very small Indian tribe in Arizona, and 6 departments and a grant and a scholarship funded my way here, so I have assignments from every department. About 90% of our collection of artifacts and documents is spread around a variety of museums and institutions, mm-hmm. and somewhere within the next 3 to 5 years, we'd like to start bringing that back in preparation for the next 5 to 10 years building a cultural center. And I've had the same problem you have in that best practices are not necessarily helping us design not only a temporary storage but a permanent cultural center. Where should I look for information that I can give to those departments who sent me here on how we build a temporary storage in preparation for building a cultural center?
Where in Arizona are you?
Prescott.
Prescott. I mean, I think the answer would be maybe to start outside of our field. And just like, I don't know, this Prescott or Arizona government have any kind of local sustainability initiatives or planning?
The closest thing we have is probably the Heard Museum in Phoenix, who about 20 years ago put in an archive and then discovered they had to retrofit it with humidity controls. So I can talk to them about that. But again, that was 20 years ago, and I'm hoping that technology has improved. So if all else fails, I'll start with
them.
Thanks.
And also, I think I would imagine is there anyone from Arizona in the room that has an answer to this question? Okay. Also, have you contacted, is there an Arizona State Historical Records Advisory Board?
There is.
Okay. Have you been in touch with them?
I used to work for them.
Oh. okay.
They built a new record center.
Uh-huh.
Where you have extremes in the seasons, you can adapt by percentages of, 3 to 5% gradually. And I just wanted to mention that. I think it's just one of their many great ideas for really practical common sense solutions. And they talked a lot about looking back to vernacular architecture and how, by necessity, they had to take advantage of scarce resources. So just a comment, really.
Yeah.
And thank you for a great presentation.
Sure, yeah, just a quick follow-up on that. I would recommend that you go to their website. I remember after that plenary going on, there wasn't a ton of information there yet, but if you haven't looked, since 2014 or whatever, there is more on there now, and including some really interesting videos, sort of time-lapse videos showing the effects of different amounts of humidity and temperature changes on books, which are mixed media objects, and so you can kind of see some of the things happening. So it's definitely worth a little bit of your time.
And they have webinars too.
Yes.
Webinars.
I don't know if anybody heard that. They have webinars.
Yeah.
We have about 2 more minutes, and I want to be cognizant of all of your time and make sure you have time to get coffee and take care of yourself before the final plenary. So we have possibly 1 more question. I don't see someone at the microphone. Yes, I do. I see someone at the microphone. Thank you, Kate. Please join me in thanking our fabulous speakers.